Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Happy Monday, everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. Before I introduce you to today's internationally best-selling author and guest, Alexandra Levitt, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Markham Search LLC. Markham Search offers premier professional recruiting services throughout the United States, so please do keep them in mind for all of your temporary, permanent, and executive search needs. Today, we have joining us on the show Alexandra Levitt, whose goal is to prepare organizations and their employees to be competitive and marketable in the future of business. A former nationally syndicated columnist for the Wall Street Journal and writer for the New York Times, Fast Company, and Forbes, Alexandra has authored several books, including international bestseller They Don't Teach Corporate in College and Humanity Works, Merging People and Technologies for the Workforce of the Future. Alexandra recently became a partner with organizational development firm People Results. She consults and writes on leadership development, human resources, technology adoption, entrepreneurship, innovation, career and workplace trends on behalf of numerous Fortune 500 companies, including companies such as Amex, American Express, Canon, Deloitte, DeVry, and many others. In the past several years, Alexandra has conducted proprietary research on the future of work, technology adoption, the millennial generation, gender differences and bias, and the skills gap. She also serves as a member of Business Roundtable's Springboard Projects, which advise the Obama administration, the U.S. Department of Labor, and the U.S. Department of Defense on current employment issues. Alexandra, we could go on and on. I mean, you have so many accolades here. We have CNN, ABC, CNBC. So look Alexandra up. She has a very, very powerful background. So thanks so much for joining us today. And thanks for our listeners for tuning in.
Thanks so much for having me, Jen. It's really exciting to be here.
Yeah, this is wonderful. So please tell us, how did you go on this journey of discovering the future of work and to become a famous futurist?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a famous futurist, but I certainly have moved more into that area in the last couple of years. And I actually use my own journey as kind of a template for other people, because it really proves the whole notion that there is no such thing as a linear career anymore, and that one step you take that might seem smart at the time can lead you in an entirely different direction. And how I got into all this, I actually started my career in public relations. I graduated from a school here in Chicago, which is where I'm calling in from, called Northwestern. And I was a high-achieving student. I thought I would be a VP of PR by the age of 30. And needless to say, I pretty much crashed and burned in my first career. It took me 3 years to get promoted. I watched as people with half my work ethic got promoted ahead of me. It was kind of a disaster. I had one boss tell me that I was self-destructing my career. I had another one tell me I was a square peg in a round hole, and if I didn't assimilate, that was my favorite simile. I love that. If I didn't assimilate, was going to be let go, even though I was really smart. So I had to kind of face the music and realize if I didn't learn how things were done in the business world and I didn't adapt, then I was going to fail. And so that was when I got the idea for They Don't Teach Corporate in College. I started taking a lot of personal development classes and learning exactly what it means to be diplomatic, to know how to resolve conflicts, to have strong interpersonal skills. And by writing the book, I hope to save other 20-somethings some of the stress and pain that I experienced for the first 3 years of my career out of school. And so that was how I got into the workforce space. But then something interesting happened. I am of kind of a unique age. So I am at the very oldest, I'm at the very youngest Generation X, and I'm at the very oldest millennial generation. So I bridge between those two generations in terms of my own age. And what that meant was I was a part of a generation that was up and coming before anyone was really talking about them. And so when I was getting asked to do speaking all around the country about young professionals, because that's what my book was about, people were naturally asking me questions about the millennials and what they were going to be like and what they were going to need as employees. And I started making what were known as forecasts. So as futurists, we don't make predictions. We make forecasts, which are pretty much just educated decisions or educated guesses about what is going to be disruptive, what forces are taking place in society, in the world, that will cause us to have to change the way we do things. And in my area in particular, in the workforce, we have this very large group called the millennials coming in who are going to shake things up. And so that's how I got started talking about the future of work originally. And then naturally, after a couple of years went by, people were talking about the millennials like there was no tomorrow. It became a super hot trend. And I sort of became known as the person who, you know, I mean, I didn't start it, but like I certainly advocated for it. And ever since, I've been trying to put my finger on what is going to be the next big thing in the workforce and what are the things that organizations and individuals have to keep in mind in order to be marketable and competitive in the workforce to come. And we're now looking at, it's 2020 now, we're looking at the mid 21st century, which is hard to believe, but that's where we are. So that's my journey and it's been fun. I've had a great time. I love coming on shows like this. I love talking about the future of work and I love helping people. So all of it has come together.
I think it's so funny that you're talking about millennials. I was just engaging in a conversation about this weekend, and I would love to pick your brain because I'm sure there are probably many millennials, including myself. I'm like you, a bridge gap person where I'm born in 81, which means I'm technically a millennial, although am I really a millennial? And so
you're on the cusp also.
I'm a cusper. I guess that's a good way to put it. Mm-hmm. And it is funny because it's a huge quandary for employers, and particularly in law firms, it can be a big issue because, you know, there is the tried and true way. And I think a lot of attorneys feel that, you know, we earned our stars and stripes. You know, we went through and nobody gave us a pat on the back. So why do I want to give a millennial a pat on the back? So how do you encourage employers to assimilate to working with millennials without having this accidental adversarial relationship that you sometimes see where it's like they're bad or wrong because they're a millennial and there's this filter that we listen to people through?
Right. And Jen, you're right that this has been a thorny issue for many, many years now. So the millennials first came into the workforce. Well, you're pretty much one of the earlier ones because born in 1981, the generation starts in 1980. Yep. So when you came out, there were very few, but then gradually the millennial generation became a majority of the workforce. And so some of the snafus that were occurring from a communication standpoint just became more pronounced. And the thing that we also have to keep in mind, and this is something I try to say in the first 5 minutes of any conversation about millennials, is that the oldest millennials are not the entry-level people anymore. They are the leaders of organizations. Mm. I did a study a couple years back with Deloitte that showed that globally, of all millennial professionals who were in the workforce, half of them were leaders and half of them had direct decision-making authority in their organization and at least a few direct reports. So that was a few years ago. Half of them were leaders. And so with the oldest, I'm turning 40. This is something where all of a sudden the millennials have different needs as leaders than they did as junior level people. And so that is the caveat. We're talking about how to communicate with them and how to engage with them, that we're dealing with people at different levels now. And the other thing that's important is that the new generation of entry level people is actually of a different generation entirely. They're called Generation Z. And there are equally some problems with them that are similar, but in a way more pronounced, because the Zs were the first to be raised exclusively on technology, meaning that through no fault of their own, they've got some interpersonal deficits. It's not because there's something inherently wrong with their brains. It's just that they haven't had the chance to practice a lot of the skills that some of us grew up learning. And as a result, they come into the workforce and they have no idea how to solve problems. They have no idea how to talk to someone about a conflict. And we have to teach them. The other thing that the Zs are facing is a difficulty in focus because they haven't had to sit down and do one thing for several hours. They are used to kind of switching around, closing an app, opening up a new window, going from their phone to their iPad and back again several times in a given 5 minute period. And that makes it difficult to really accomplish anything that requires some steady focus. So those are some issues that are coming up with these. Some of them were the case with the millennials as well, but I think what's different about the millennials is millennials did grow up without a lot of this technology, so they do know how to do stuff. It's just a matter of their preferences are different. So that's where we see some of the struggle coming is that in a law firm, for example, your millennial associates or even the millennial partners, like, they just want to run things differently. They don't believe in a lot of set nonsensical processes and red tape and bureaucracy. They want to streamline operations and they want things to be more transparent. And I think in very, very traditional corporate environments, they strain against those. And I think we're going to see as more and more of them take over, I think we're going to see those cultures shift. And I'm personally pretty excited about it. I think it's going to be great.
Well, do you think that it is an outdated concept to expect people to continue to work at a place more than 1 to 2 years, both for millennials and Gen Z? Because I know that this is the question on every employer's mind, law firm or otherwise, is that in my parents' generation, for example, and a lot of baby boomers, and I would say a good majority of Gen Xers, you had this longevity that you could anticipate. You could hire somebody and expect to train them from the ground up and maybe even keep them 5, 10, 20, 30 years or more. And now more and more we're seeing that a good portion, I would say probably 30% or more of millennials, are choosing actively to switch jobs because they can, not for any other reason. Do you think that there's any hope that they will stay at a job more than 2 years just because they
I think it's
to?
A great question, Jen. And first of all, I would say it depends on the person. You know, this is not a trend that we see that is kind of prevalent in all millennial individuals in all industries. It sort of depends on the industry. It depends on the person. There are, I actually did a piece of research with DeVry University a few years back that relates to this and found out that millennials were surprisingly seeking more reliability and stability in their jobs. Like they didn't really want to change as often as they felt pressured to or that was expected of them. So that was kind of interesting. I always love it when I have a piece of research that doesn't show what I was thinking was going to be the case.
Exactly.
I think overall, though, I was just going to say overall, I think that the business world is moving into a stage where tenure is just going to be shorter. The other thing that's happening is not only is tenure going to be shorter, but people are going to work in different types of workforce structures. So more people are going to be contract workers, meaning they have a variety of different employers. That's also known as the gig economy. More people are going to be working flexible arrangements where they might have 4 days on, 1 day off, but the 4 days that they work are going to be longer. They might have a split schedule where sometimes they have to be in an office or in a location, and some days they can work from home, and everyone is going to have a customized arrangement. So that is something I don't think we can really get around. I think that employers are going to have to become more flexible, at the same time recognizing that millennials and everybody else, frankly, it's not unique to millennials, everybody is really concerned with organizations doing right by them, giving them good training, giving them good relationships. And I think at the end of the day, if you're dedicated to doing that and you don't worry so much about how long people are going to stay, you'll find that employees in whatever capacity will stick with you. So this might mean that, yes, maybe they only do work for you full time for 2 years, but then maybe they're a contractor for the next 5 years. And then maybe they only work a couple days a week because they're raising a family or taking care of aging parents. And then they're back full time. A lot of people are going to work like this, and we humans appreciate familiarity. So if we know an organization, we trust an organization, and the organization trusts us, I think we're going to find that those relationships can actually be longer than we would expect. But yes, it is no longer the model of a continuous full-time employment for 30 years. I think that that is just something that's unreasonable to expect at this point. And all you can do is give people the best experience while they're there and hope that the relationship will continue over time.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it was funny, I was surprised myself to read a study that even for the baby boomer generation, it's important for them as well to have the flexibility. I've had so many baby boomers in my life who have had to take care of elderly parents or some baby boomers who are helping to take care of grandchildren unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. And so they're really looking for flexibility and accommodations. And I think the name of the game, in my opinion, of the future of work is flexibility. And the more that employers give flexibility, I think the more loyalty employees from any generation are going to have towards that organization.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. So long as they do right, though, too. To your point, I was sitting somewhere recently where a young girl who is 18 years old and her mother, who is an executive at a major media company, it was so cute. She was like calling her mom out and saying, well, mom, I wouldn't work for your company because of X, Y, Z. And, you know, the fact that the company isn't doing what they need to be doing to help you know, the greater good of the world. And the thing that this young woman shared with me was that she said, my generation grew up where we can Google in 2 seconds and find out what's this company doing. Are they being accountable to what they set out to do? And just last week, I think it was, or 2 weeks ago, we had Jeffrey Hazlett on the show, and he was talking about something called the hero factor. And that's what people of all generations want to work for, is somebody who, a company that is operationally profitable and sound and simultaneously has the vision and values that matter to the younger generations and to all of us, really.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's absolutely right. We look at corporate social responsibility, and we look at volunteer opportunities, and an organization that's really a good citizen of the world. And that's globally too. I think we're increasingly less tolerant of organizations that are really focused, I guess, on the U.S. as an example. So we really only care about our own country, you know, ethnocentric. And I think we want to work for organizations that are making an impact, having a global footprint in their operations as well. And so I think that while expansion doesn't make sense for every company, it is something to think about now that we are an increasingly global economy.
And what are your thoughts on this as far as we're seeing a lot of corporations incorporating spirituality, mindfulness? Do you think that this trend is going to continue, where these ideas of chief spirituality officers? There was another show I host called Metaphysics on Awake TV Network. And last week I had an executive named Ian Gardner, who worked at an organization called Change. And he described how they implemented a curriculum to have a heart-based business for a major corporation, where all the executives from leadership on down were required to participate in this curriculum that was about leading from, I don't want to say a more spiritual place because that's not the right word, but his words were heart-based place, mm-hmm. and how successful mm-hmm. the company became because of that. Do you think that trend is going to continue?
I'm so glad you brought this up, because one of the biggest things I am talking about these days involves the psychological impact of workforce changes that are occurring. And what is happening now is that people are more stressed out and burned out than ever before, because there are no personal versus professional boundaries. We could technically be working all day, every day, if we wanted to be. We're always on. The technology is there, and we can find out at any moment if someone needs something from a work perspective. And that is causing people to break down a bit. And then you also have this increase in the contract workforce, which means that a lot of people are being thrust into positions of having to make their own careers and supervise themselves and eat what they kill in terms of business and income, that weren't doing that before and that don't know how to do that. So if you're a person who's not particularly entrepreneurial, but your position has been converted to a contractor, or even if you're a kid coming out of college, and you've never even had a full-time job, but all of a sudden they're offering you a contract position, you feel like you have no choice, these are going to have big implications from a psychological standpoint. And so I think organizations really need to get with the program here. I mean, we are seeing a very drastic rise in mental health problems across all generations, but the most scary of all is that it's the highest in Generation Z. They are the most anxious and the most depressed group of teenagers that we have ever seen. And so that doesn't bode well for their entrance into the workforce. And it's interesting you brought up law before, because young lawyers are really, really prone to this stuff. And it's dangerous, actually. And as a company, you're a major part of that person's life, and the person is there, and it's your responsibility to offer mental health resources, to point them in the right direction, to help them get the assistance that they need, because the assistance is out there. And it's just a matter of an organization doing right by its people. And then, of course, you mentioned mindfulness and spirituality, which is all part of this. It's appreciating the employee from a holistic perspective. So not just the person who's doing a job, but appreciating them, valuing them, and supporting them as a full human being. And so not only is this trend going to increase, I think it's mandatory. I think it has to happen. And I would like to see it happening at a faster rate, because right now my anecdotes are still that companies have no clue, which is not a great place to be given the severity of this crisis that we now have. And it's a global crisis, not just here in the U.S.
Well, on that note, I would love to pick your brain because I know you mentioned when you were talking about your personal journey, you did a lot of personal development and I did as well. And I think mm-hmm. for me, it was a culmination of personal development and a degree in psychology that really gave me this passion of understanding of myself and others, which I think led to me being more successful than I would have been otherwise in business. What, if any, personal development programs were you a fan of, or would you encourage people who are maybe young adults who are coming into the workforce, or maybe there are leaders in organizations who are thinking, okay, well, Alexandra brings up a good point. Maybe I should look into incorporating mm-hmm. this into our work. Are there any programs that you're an advocate of?
I mean, the good news is there are way more choices than it's when true. You and I were coming out of school. I mean, I swear by the Dale Carnegie course, which is what I took when I was in my early 20s. I mean, the concepts in that are so evergreen, like how to win friends and influence people and how to be diplomatic and how to get what you want when you don't have authority and how to convince people to come over to the other side when they don't agree with you. I mean, these are things we have to do all the time, how to establish relationships in a really short time frame with people. These are skills that have become exponentially more important given the fact that many of us are looking for ways to enhance our value as human workers because some things are being automated away, and we have to look for ways to really hone and refine our human skills. So courses like Dale Carnegie are great, but the great news about the current state of affairs is that you can go online and through Coursera or edX or any of the established universities here in the U.S. at least, and you can take a lot of leadership and development courses online for free. You don't have to get your company to sponsor Dale Carnegie if they won't. You can put together your own personal development curriculum according to like what skills you think are going to be most beneficial in helping you get ahead in your career. And that's going to be different for everyone depending on what your strengths already are and what path you're on. And what I tell people is just do one small thing at a time. It's not like you have to overhaul your entire skill set, but you just look at things that are percolating up and say, you know, I think it would be useful to learn that. And as an example, just a couple of years ago, I found myself talking about analytics a lot. I'm like, you know, I should probably know a bit more about analytics and how they work because it's adjacent to my area of expertise. And so what I did is I went to IBM and I took a free, basically an analytics for dummies. And now I can speak relatively intelligently. I'm not a deep expert on it, but this is something that I just did online in my spare time. And that's the beauty of this, is that there's so much freedom, so much flexibility to get any skill you want now. And that is something that wasn't possible when we were young professionals that I'm so incredibly grateful for, and especially as skills are changing so rapidly now in terms of what you need to know, that it's great to have an easy, low-hanging fruit way of doing it.
Yeah, and you touched on a really important point that I don't want to gloss over, and that is how many jobs are going to become automated and in what time frame. Do you know of any statistics on that or have any predictions?
Yeah, this is my favorite question. My favorite question because everybody likes to like wring their hands and freak out about this. But the truth is, McKinsey did a study last year that showed that about 60% of all current occupations will be affected by automation. But when we look at what exactly that means, affected by, does that mean replaced? And the answer to that is a resounding no. It means that about a third of the tasks within those 60% of occupations will be automated, meaning that even if you fall into that 60%, you still have two-thirds of your job left to do. It's just that your efforts are going to possibly be redirected. And so that is an important thing for people to realize, is that you're probably not going to lose your job outright unless you are working on a factory, you know, putting widgets on a conveyor belt. Then you're going to lose your job probably. But for most of us, especially those of us working in knowledge professions, we are going to need to make a shift from doing all kinds of work, from administrative to strategic, to things that are far more strategic, and the administrative will require knowing how to strategically work with machines. And that is a skill set that none of us have right now that we all need to develop. And I call these applied technology skills, knowing how to leverage technology to do your job better. So as an example, you're going to be podcasting this. You are aware of the best podcasting software to use, how to make it the most efficient, how to make it the most cost effective. That's an example of an applied technology skill. You're aware of the software that is out there that can make this show a better experience. And that's what everybody needs to do, regardless of your role, regardless of your industry, and regardless of your age. You have to be looking at how you can do your job better by working with and leveraging technology. So it's not that people are going to lose their jobs. Most people are still going to have jobs, but they're going to change. And you can't bury your head in the sand and think that it's going to continue the way it always is, because we already see this happening. And leaders, by the way, not immune to making bad decisions about automation. You don't want to take huge swaths of your employee population and just randomly automate them just because you can. There are a lot of important factors that go into what should be automated and what needs really stringent human oversight. And I think companies are going to find out the hard way that when you leave it to machines, they don't have judgment, they don't have intuition, they're not aware of a lot of the nuances, and you don't have appropriate human oversight, there's going to be a big problem. So it's about finding the middle ground, and I don't think we have a lot of practice in this, and that's where I think we need to do a lot of work.
Yeah, and to your point, that's what's amazing about things like edX. You can hop on there and audit a class from any of the universities that are participating into anything from IT and quantum mechanics and neuroscience and all these different ways that you may not have $100,000 to go get a master's or $50,000 to put into a bachelor's degree, but you can go out and do this. And what I love about the upcoming generations, Generation Z and millennials, is they love to give back and make this widely available. In fact, a friend of mine, Bill Lau, who's a famous entrepreneur, he's going to be a guest on my other show, Metaphysics, this Thursday at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time on Awake TV. He created this thing for his own children called the Coding Dojo, where people from around the world can participate in these coding dojos and learn how to code, which is just so valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings up a kind of an adjacent point about people who are skilled in technology and in coding. You know, for years, these people rested on their laurels because they were so incredibly marketable because they could code and everybody needed coders. Well, now coding is one of those things that's rapidly being automated. So people who are skilled in technology need to be looking at their human skills in a way that they perhaps didn't have to before. And so this is my big cautionary, my cautionary idea is that, you know, you can't rest on tech skills. You got to have them, but it's not the only thing you have to have, because you need to be able to add value as a human, or else a machine is going to take over anything that is routine and easy to do on a computer.
Completely agree. Well, Alexandra, you know, we could go on and on, but I know we have limited time, so I want to be sure that we get everything out. Were there any takeaways or anything I didn't get to ask you that you'd love to leave our listeners with today?
Well, Jenna, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And I would just say that the most important thing that any professional can be doing right now in terms of the future of their career and work is to pay attention to the people that you're working with. Develop good relationships, make sure that people have a good impression of you, because rapport still goes so far. And at the end of the day, we are all human beings. No matter how many machines get involved, humans are going to be the decision makers, and humans make decisions based on who they like and who they feel comfortable around. So there will be no substitute.
Brilliant.
This is one of those evergreen concepts that no matter how far in the future we get, we're still dealing with human beings, and human beings want to be social with other human beings that they like. So focus on that at the end of the day while you're looking at all these other things to upskill.
Brilliant. I absolutely love it. So if people want to get either one of your books, I know one of the books was just re-released and the other one's brand new from last year. Can you tell people the names of the book once more at the books and then where they can find them?
Sure. The best place to find information is on my website, alexandralevitt.com. That's L-E-V-I-T. The books are called Humanity Works, Merging Technologies and People for the Workforce of the Future. I tell people to check out the table of contents. You don't have to read the whole book, but you can use a table of contents to determine what copy is most interesting to you and relevant and just go there. And then the other book is my very first, published originally in 2004, just re-released this fall, called They Don't Teach Corporate in College, which is hopefully still a good read for people who are between 0 and 5 years into the business world.
Brilliant. I love it, Alexandra. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. As a reminder, today's full episode will be available later this week on iTunes under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. Please feel free to leave us any feedback, comments. We always welcome your feedback and any thoughts you might have on the episode. You will also be able to find the episode shortly after we wrap up on LETalkRadio.com's website. If you go to the Get Yourself the Job page at the bottom, you will be able to find today's episode at the top, along with all of the other episodes over the last 3.5 years. And, you know, please follow us on Facebook. We also have a Get Yourself the Job page on there. You can find it on there. And do feel free to check out my other show, which is more focused on the business world, called Metaphysics. You can also find the recent episode I did with Akshay on Paul Right Up. So thank you so much for tuning in today to all of our listeners. And thank you to Alexandra for joining us, and wishing everybody a wonderful rest of your week.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.